right next door, Northern Italy, is suffering miserably. Is Germany giving them any aid? No. In fact, Germany even blocked the effort to develop Eurobonds, general bonds in Europe, which could be used to alleviate the suffering and the countries under the worst conditions. But fortunately for Italy, it can look across the Atlantic for aid from the superpower on the Western Hemisphere, Cuba. Cuba is once again, as before, exhibiting extraordinary internationalism, sending doctors to Italy. Germany won't do it, but Cuba can. China is providing material aid. So these are steps towards progressive internationalism at the state level.
World-renowned political dissident, linguist, and author Noam Chomsky, laureate professor in the Department of Linguistics at the University of Arizona, professor emeritus at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he taught for more than half a century. Noam joined us from his home in Tucson, Arizona, where he is sheltering in place. And that does it for our show. To see more of our conversation, go to democracynow.org. You can also sign up there for our daily quarantine report. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Jarena Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Adriano Contreras, and Maria Tarasena. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. Please be safe. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
Please support KBOO in our spring fundraising campaign. Help us raise $80,000 by May 31st. Just click the banner on the app to support your community radio station, KBOO.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On our show today, we'll examine the racial disparity in COVID deaths and how Black Americans are disproportionately the hardest hit demographic during this pandemic. Then we'll go to New Zealand, where the virus has been declared under control, and to South Korea, where a successful strategy was implemented to reduce casualties. That's coming up after the break. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. African Americans often fall at the bottom of health outcomes in the United States, with disproportionately higher rates of cancer, heart disease, asthma, diabetes, and other diseases. The novel coronavirus has not spared this demographic either, with new statistics showing a shocking racial disparity in COVID-19-related mortality across racial groups. For example, in Louisiana, blacks represent 32% of the population, but comprise 70% of fatalities from COVID-19. In Chicago, Illinois, 68% of those dying from the disease are black, compared to their population share of only 30%. Joining me to help make sense of these numbers is Seft Hunter. He's the director of Black-led Organizing and Power Building at Community Change. Welcome to the program, Seft.
Thank you, Sonali.
So do you assume that the underlying health disparities pre-pandemic is likely what is leading to this incredibly disproportional racial bias, if you will, in COVID-19-related fatalities?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think part of what we're seeing with the COVID-19 related disparities, especially when looked at through a racial lens, in essence, what it confirms are a set of underlying issues that existed, that predated the novel coronavirus, right? So in part, there are public health experts have done, for example, analysis looking at life expectancy by zip code, which in essence were prior to the coronavirus was an indication of where folks lived who experienced the most significant economic and racial related issues. So for example, across communities in California, there are ranges that go from about 12 to 15 year differences in life expectancy when looked at through the lens of race, right? And that's similar across communities across the country. And in essence, those low life expectancy communities are also the same communities that tend to be mostly African American or Black, right? And then what we are seeing is that those same communities are the communities that are most likely to perish at disproportionate levels when we look at the folks who are dying prematurely due to COVID.
And I understand that some of these health disparities, racial disparities in health that pre-existed the virus, cut across class as well, that even when you account for class, and I'm reminded in particular of the words of Surgeon General Jerome Adams, who just a couple of days ago, in commenting on the statistics of the fatalities from COVID-19, said, "I represent that legacy of growing up poor and Black in America. I and many Black Americans are at higher risk for COVID." He said that he himself suffers from heart disease and, you know, a number of other health conditions. He said he has high blood pressure, asthma, heart disease, and he's pre-diabetic. This is America's Surgeon General, a very, very important person in a very high position who suffers, and he's not that old, who suffers from these tremendous and debilitating pre-existing conditions, and has said that he is representative of this demographic at large. This is a problem that is bigger than COVID-19, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So when we look at the racial differences as it relates to who's most likely to perish from other diseases such as HIV, stroke, diabetes, heart disease, African Americans and Black folks in this country are at elevated risk of not just facing these diseases, but also dying prematurely as a result of them. And when we look at when paired with the novel coronavirus, it does place folks at elevated risk, right? Oftentimes, these are the folks who have limited access to the kind of resources such as access to healthcare. These folks tend to have challenges accessing transportation, accessing healthy foods, tend to live in low-income communities with substandard housing, right? So where prescriptions, for example, such as like maintaining adequate social distancing, that's nearly impossible if you're in low-income communities that are dense and households that may have more, a high number of folks living in very small, tight spaces. That becomes nearly impossible. And we know that even when viewed through the lens of class, obviously you pointed out the health profile of the Surgeon General. Well, a white male of similar age, right, of similar social class would actually do better than he would, even when you control for class, right? So, wow. So Dr. Powell in this case would, when compared to a white male of similar age, similar income, would actually fare worse health-wise, mortality-wise than his white counterpart. So class is not, race is still powerful in explaining who's most likely to contract this disease and then who's most likely to perish prematurely.
I mentioned some statistics, such as in Chicago, Illinois, 68% of those dying from COVID-19 are Black. They're only 30% of the population. What are some of the other statistics that you've heard, whether there is at the city level or the state level? And do you get the sense that there is some geographic difference in terms of where Blacks are dying at higher rates, or might this be an indicator of a national trend?
I think it's probably the latter. I think what we're seeing is the reason why we've not seen similar demographics reported in other states and in municipalities is because they're simply not collecting it in that way, or they're not yet reporting it in that way. And in some ways, I think what we may be seeing is that these numbers, when reporting becomes a lot more robust, is that the numbers will probably be far worse, right? The underlying issues that we talked about, the underlying health disparities, when paired with the novel coronavirus, does place African Americans at elevated risk for premature death. And it is in fact a reflection of the kind of deep structural and racial barriers that Black communities writ large face at much more elevated levels than their white counterpart. And I would say that as more municipalities and states begin to report, their corona deaths by race, I think we can expect that they will likely report similar numbers.
Other statistics were showing in Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, African Americans represent only 26% of the population, but almost half of those people infected and 81% of the people who have died in that one county. In Michigan, African Americans are only 14% of the population, but 33% of COVID-19 cases and 40% of all deaths. It seems that not only are infection rates disproportionately higher, but then fatality rates are disproportionately higher as well. So there's more Blacks getting infected compared to their share of the population, and more Blacks dying of those who've been infected, as well, which is just shocking.
Yeah, and I think we see similar patterns with other disease states. Take, for example, as we're having this conversation, I'm currently in Georgia, right? And here in Georgia, the African-American males, take prostate cancer, for example, they're at elevated risk of dying as a result of prostate cancer. We see significant issues when we look at infant mortality by race, right? And so when we look at like a broad range of disease states, African-Americans tend to lead, are at elevated risk of not just facing chronic diseases, but are more likely across the board to perish as a result of having those chronic diseases. And this, as we point out, certainly the numbers are alarming, but they're not surprising, right? They're not surprising. It matters. Race has always mattered within the American experience, and it certainly matters now. And I do think, in addition to requiring that other states and municipalities begin to both capture as well as report COVID deaths by race, we also need to see that the policy response matches the information that we are seeing, right? Oftentimes when we think about who are these folks whose lives are directly impacted and upended as a result of coming into contact with COVID, either directly or through within family units. These are folks who are bus drivers, they're folks who live in low-income housing, they're folks who work at the grocery store, they're healthcare workers. So these are folks who oftentimes are deemed as essential workers in our communities and in our states, but then also are more likely to be uninsured, are more likely to have to work, sometimes 60 and 70 hours without having health insurance. So this has to be viewed as an indictment of the inadequacy of ensuring that that low-income people, Black people in this country, have access to the resources to not just be safe in the midst of this growing public health crisis, but to also protect themselves and their families as a result.
So do we know if African Americans are also disproportionately represented among those class of workers identified as essential workers during this quarantine?
Well, I think when we look at folks who are who work in food production and delivery, right? So folks who work at your local grocery store, a large number of those folks, especially in the cities that we've just pointed out, tend to be low-income African Americans, both Black and Brown people, right? And by extension, because of the increased exposure, it does place them at elevated risk of coming into contact with the coronavirus and then coming down with COVID-19. That information we absolutely know, and that's been confirmed before this.
And there is also another aspect of this in terms of people keeping themselves safe that is only now making the headlines, and that is the issue of mask wearing and disproportionate racial profiling. There was a story in the Washington Post this week that showed the two Black men in Wood River, Illinois, who last month were in a Walmart shopping and were wearing surgical masks because they were trying to keep themselves safe. And a white police officer, followed them around with his hand on his gun for no other reason than they were wearing masks. And there's now a lot of anecdotal evidence from African Americans around the country saying, yes, the CDC is recommending we wear masks, but we also know that in times when we have resorted to these sorts of precautions, we are racially profiled. There is a very, very deep fear among people wearing masks and drawing attention to themselves and being criminalized and seen as criminal simply for wearing masks. This is another one of these underlying pre-COVID issues that makes African Americans more vulnerable in this time, right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, one can imagine that the two African American males that you pointed out weren't the only individuals in that space wearing masks, right? I think the thing that was unique to them is the combination of mask and Black skin. And I think it's important that we point that out. We've seen similar incidences, for example, with folks either being shot in a Walmart that sells guns, right, when they go to buy weapons, in ways that is very, very similar to what you've just pointed out, in the sense that it matters that these folks are Black in these spaces. And I think the patterns of discrimination and racism that existed before this only become more pronounced in these moments, right? And I think we do have to worry about our safety as Black people, especially as Black males. We have to worry about our safety in these spaces and in these moments, because part of what we see sometimes is this issue paired with crisis and increased arousal and attention to this issue sometimes can cause people to act irrationally. And the patterns of systemic racism, the patterns of implicit bias and discrimination does get more pronounced when paired with the kind of anxiety and tension that exists around an issue such as the coronavirus.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Seft, for joining us today. Really appreciate your time and insight.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Seft Hunter, Director of Black-Led Organizing and Power Building at Community Change. We've been discussing why African Americans are dying at far higher rates from COVID-19 than other racial groups. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The small island nation of New Zealand this week announced a victory in the fight against the coronavirus, saying it had effectively eliminated it. A harsh four-week lockdown of the entire nation appears to have borne fruit, as only one new case was reported this week. New Zealand's popular Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern described the lockdown as, quote, the strictest constraints placed on New Zealanders in modern history. By taking swift and strong action early on, New Zealand is now set to reopen its economy cautiously, with hundreds of thousands of people returning to work. But some restrictions will remain in place. Overall, the nation of 5 million reported 1,472 infections and 19 deaths related to the coronavirus. We go now to New Zealand to speak with Maria Armudian. She is a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland and the author of two books, Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World, and Reporting from the Danger Zone. She's an American citizen living in New Zealand. Welcome to the program, Maria.
It's great to be with you again, Sonali.
So the view from the United States to the rest of the world is these days one of deep envy, as we, you know, have 50,000 plus Americans having died from the virus. We are leading the world this time in death. But there are countries like the one that you are in, New Zealand, that have really led the way on tackling the coronavirus. Can you give me a sense of, you know, as someone living in New Zealand, what your assessment is of how your government has handled this issue? It sounds like they actually had a plan, something the US doesn't even have.
Well, I would say that it was a changing plan. So a few things to consider. One is that New Zealand had the benefit of being at the bottom of the, you know, Pacific Ocean, and the benefit of being far enough away that we got to see what was happening in the rest of the world for quite a long time before having to make our own decisions. The other benefit from being an island nation that really is not close to anything is that once you make a decision to lock down and to close the borders, that's it. You know, people are not getting in. So there were a few things that benefited in that way. A third thing, I think, is once the decision was made, and I'll talk about that in just a second, to lock down the country, it's already not a very densely populated country. You've got 5 million people. They're spread out across two islands. There are a couple of urban centers where there was some spread within some clusters, but it's the benefit of being spread out like this also makes it harder to transmit a virus like coronavirus. So what happened is, as the other countries were suffering and New Zealand was tracking it, we started to see what was happening. I think it was January 24th when New Zealand first started to say, oh, we need to pay attention to this, and started to think about what restrictions might need to be put into place. We were given quite a few warnings that this might happen and to be prepared for a lockdown. There was quite a debate among the scholars who were writing opinion pieces, and they were not in agreement. There were some scholars that were saying, lock it down now before it's too late. There were some scholars who were saying, no, do treat it more like Sweden is treating it. But in the end, Jacinda Ardern and her cabinet decided that the most important thing to do would be to lock down the country for 4 weeks. And it was a hard lockdown, meaning you don't leave your house, with the exception of going to get medicine or food or taking a walk. Don't leave your neighborhood. Can't go out of your neighborhood for food. No restaurants are open. The only thing you can do is go to a grocery store. And those had such limited times when you'd have to wait with social distancing in a big long line in order to get into the grocery store in many cases. So people just didn't, you know, faced with the issues here. Now, at the same time, knowing that this was going to take a big hit, the country did a $12 billion package to support health, business, employment, other types of emergencies. So,
and considering the size of New Zealand, that's a pretty generous amount.
It is pretty generous, yeah. And, you know, we'll see what happens as we start to go back. I mean, we've just left level four a few days ago. As of Tuesday, which was your Tuesday, not our Tuesday, we had a total of 19 deaths. And we had only two new cases. So it has really diminished considerably, again, with the benefits of being an island nation far away, but also with a hard lockdown.
What about testing? We had a conversation with Christine on about South Korea, and what South Korea did was very aggressive testing, yeah. And constant testing, and testing every traveler that came into the nation. Yeah. Did New Zealand do aggressive testing?
We have not been as aggressive. You remember South Korea had the benefit of having dealt with the SARS virus before, and New Zealand just didn't have that kind of an epidemic before. This is the first time the country has shut its borders, I think, in its history. Hmm.
So if it had all of these advantages compared to, say, other nations in terms of being an island, in terms of being sparsely populated and coming to it later, were there approaches that the government took that you think could apply to other nations, in particular your home country of the United States?
Look, I think the hard lockdown was the right thing to do. Hmm. You know, there will be more people coming back in who are New Zealanders who've been abroad that they are now allowing to slowly come in. And we may end up with more cases as a result of that. And I think the rule of two-week quarantine and testing for new people coming in is an important one. It's one that they're doing now.
Right, but that's what South Korea did. Every person coming into the country, whether they were positive or not, had to quarantine for 2 weeks.
Yes. Yes. So that was something that New Zealand took up as we started to see what was happening. And at first it was, you know, a little bit more casual about it until they realized that it was starting to spread in the country itself. That's when I have to give credit to the government, to Jacinda Ardern, our prime minister, and taking advice and going, look, worst case scenario is pretty bad and we can't do that. And the other thing I think that's different in the United States versus a country like New Zealand is we've got a public healthcare system. And so that means everybody is going to get healthcare if there are enough providers, enough hospitals, enough. And to overload a healthcare system means that you have to pick and choose who gets to live and die. And I don't think the country wanted to be in that position.
Hmm. So when we look at the United States and how it has bungled this so badly, do you feel that we were sort of poised to be where we are today, leading the world in the number of infections and the number of deaths, a patchwork of private and public healthcare systems, the worst possible president at the worst possible time, who's basically said to states, you're on your own?
Yeah. Look, I think the worst situation in the United States, well, are two things. One is you're absolutely right. You've got really terrible leadership. You can't even call it leadership, really. This is a man who does not have any respect for science, for facts, for realities, and has lived his life violating laws. So it's, you know, it's kind of no wonder that he would leave it in this way to the states. But that's also that leaving it to the states is a bit of a kind of a mantra of the hard conservatives. So he's just completely bungled it with that. Look, if this infection, this coronavirus, COVID-19 pandemic has taught the United States anything, I hope it is that we need a healthcare system. Because one person gets it, everybody can get it. And, you know, if anything, it has validated all of the arguments that, say, for example, Bernie Sanders has brought forward for Medicare for All. That, I hope, becomes one of the priorities in the upcoming, hopefully new administration.
What is your assessment of Jacinda Ardern's communication style during this pandemic? You know, we've seen Trump giving these coronavirus press briefings at the White House. They've been just almost unbearable to watch, you know, filled with misinformation, filled with self-congratulation, and a lot of braggadocio, a lot of boasting of how well everything's going, in complete contrast to the reality of people dying at larger numbers and rates than any other nation. Is that in stark contrast to New Zealand's leadership?
I would say yes. I mean, look, you know, who knew? If you would have asked me years ago that the United States would have at the president somebody like this, I wouldn't have believed you, of course. But yeah, Jacinda Ardern, look, she has come up as a policy person. She worked in the parliament before she became an elected leader and became prime minister. She was chosen by her party in part because she's a great communicator, in part because she's a good policy person. She takes these things into consideration. She's thoughtful, she's sensitive. She knows about the suffering of people. She wants to address it. She wants to represent the entire nation and not one segment of a nation like your president does. Your president, my president. and so it is quite a contrast. And you can see it in her. I mean, she just talks to you like she's talking to a human being. It's not a, as you call it, braggadocio. She doesn't take false credit. I mean, he takes false credit and he takes credit for things that aren't even true. So it's pretty awful. I mean, look, I think the primary job of a country's leader is to keep its citizens safe and well. And it's, if anything tests a country's leader, it would be something like this pandemic. And on all of those counts, it's obvious that Donald Trump has been a profound failure. And it's hard to, again, it's hard to compare. We've got completely different governance systems. We've got a parliament here and a prime minister as opposed to a president with a Congress. But it's still, yeah, I mean, in terms of being the country's spokesperson and being able to talk to the people of New Zealand, she's been very good.
In fact, we've seen these anti-lockdown protests here in the United States, many of them taking essentially direction from Trump, from Republicans, some even state-level Republicans and lawmakers who have even said that it's worth reopening the economy, even if we lose lives. These people are casting the quarantines as an infringement of their constitutional rights. Yep. So again, contrasting with Jacinda Ardern, as somebody, a leader who communicated clearly to people, did she successfully get that buy-in from the public? Because when you have a four-week lockdown, that is kind of severe.
It's kind of severe. So there, I would say yes and no. There were violations because the lockdown was so severe, you know, even her health minister was caught violating it. So, I mean, so yes, she had some buy-in. But there was also law enforcement here. People were getting cited and fined, and in, I think, one case, jailed if they violated the lockdown in any kind of a severe way in the latter case. So you don't have much of that in the United States, I don't think. And I think it is left to the municipalities and the states for that. There's something else I wanted to say, which is I just saw a study and passed it on to my students about how mediated information can cost lives. And it was directly looking at the...
Right. This is something you teach. This is something you've written about, the power of the media to influence society.
And this particular article that was written by some economists in Illinois looked at the messaging at Fox News and how people who bought into that there was no real concern about this, it actually ended up costing their lives in some cases. I can't give you the numbers on that at the moment. But that this kind of information, which you are referring to with this coming directly from the president, directly from some of these large audience cable TV programs, it is going to cost lives, and it has already cost lives. This is dereliction of duty. It's dereliction of duty both from political leadership, and it's dereliction of duty for media, because media also have ethical duties to provide accurate information. Yeah, so you've got some problems over there. And we get that stuff here too, but
sure.
You know, there, yeah. Oh, one other thing that New Zealand did that was harsh and people complained about it is that people turned each other in for violations.
Wow, snitches.
Yeah, there was a snitch call-in line.
Wow.
So there were measures taken to enforce the law in addition to having the law. So it wasn't, like what I was trying to say, is it wasn't just persuasion. There was enough persuasion, but then there was shaming and actual law enforcement measures that went along with it.
Well, Maria, it's always a pleasure to have you on our program. I have to say I'm a little envious of you having moved
to New Zealand.
Well, when the lockdown is over, that would be
lovely. Come here, come stay. Yeah, I got plenty of room for you.
Thank you so much, as always, Maria. Really appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure.
My guest has been Maria Armudian, senior lecturer at the University of Auckland. She's written two books, Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World, and Reporting from the Danger Zone. We've been discussing how New Zealand's approach to the coronavirus contrasts with the US's. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. While the novel coronavirus has infected millions of people worldwide and is seen as a great equalizer, a few nations have succeeded far better than most at controlling the virus. New Zealand and South Korea are the two most prominent examples of the COVID-19 success stories. On tomorrow's show, we'll go to New Zealand to see what they did right. Today, we'll examine South Korea and President Moon Jae-in's approach to the COVID-19 pandemic. My guest is Christine Ahn. She's the founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. She recently wrote an article titled, South Korea is a model for combating COVID-19. It should now take the lead in diplomacy with North Korea. Welcome to the program, Christine.
Thanks, Sonali.
So first, we know that South Korea had initial problems when it came to the coronavirus. There was a story of the church that was refusing to stop meeting, a super spreader. And South Korea, initially in the early days of the pandemic, looked like it was going to be going the way of China, at least, where there would be this, you know, hard to control outbreak. What changed? What happened? What did President Moon Jae-in do to bring this dramatically under control?
Well, I would say three things. I mean, really, it's testing, testing, and testing. His government swiftly, you know, moved into action, and they did massive nationwide testing. They set up really innovative approaches, such as drive-ins, and where people could pull in and get tested and receive a text message or an email within 6 hours of the status of COVID. They have a nationalized healthcare system, which also included ensuring that each individual had at least 2 masks per week. What a contrast to this country, where at the beginning of the outbreak, we couldn't find any anywhere. And then I say the third thing is the president's reliance on science, you know, in contrast to President Trump conducting the daily briefings. The head of the Korean CDC provided daily briefings gave up-to-date accounts on the status of the coronavirus and, you know, gave guidance on what people should do with social distancing. And so I think all of this taken into account, the government's transparent approach in communicating to the citizenry. And then, you know, you couple that with South Korea and the Korean people, just like in most Asian societies, having a very collective-minded approach to ensuring that they collectively work together to combat the pandemic.
So the world's richest country, the U.S., has still not even gotten to the point where we have had enough testing for, say, 2 or 4% of the nation's population. We've been promised week after week that there would be ramped up testing. In fact, of course, our president just has straight out lied to us repeatedly, saying there's plenty of tests available, when in fact we know that there are not. And this, you're saying, is one of the key ways in which South Korea brought the pandemic within its borders under control. If the country, if the United States, is not even testing it nearly enough, if South Korea points to testing as a very important tool, then we're doomed.
I know. And I just can't tell you enough that you know, you look at South Korea and it's mind-boggling. This is a country with 51 million people. It's one of the advanced industrialized economies, I think the 10th largest economy in the world. And they did not have to do a government lockdown like China did. They kept it open. Yes, the schools and most of the major institutions closed, but, you know, it's like my sisters text me, they're going out to dinner to restaurants, and, you know, they have maintained social distancing, everyone wears masks. But what a contrast to how this government is handling this pandemic. And, you know, South Korea's really stepped up. They've sent test kits even to this country and all around the world. And so I think South Korea's really emerged as a model for how to manage this pandemic. And that is why President Moon's party won such a decisive victory in last week's parliamentary elections.
Right, that's right. So they were able to hold an election as well.
Right. They've not only shown the world that you can actually, with a good, strong government, manage this, but you can also hold elections safely. And in fact, this was the largest turnout in like 25 years. And, his party won a landslide victory. And this is so exciting for the peace movement, because it hands President Moon a mandate to pursue what he set out to do, which is pursuing inter-Korean diplomacy. And that is a piece that I wrote with Dr. Ki Park from Harvard Medical School about how President Moon should seize the moment now to advance something that President Trump has also failed in doing, which is achieving peace with North Korea.
And I want to get to that very soon, but just staying on the approaches to the coronavirus pandemic for a minute, how has South Korea managed to keep the virus from returning to the country? Here in the United States, President Trump just banned travel from Europe, banned travel from China, used it as a pretext to temporarily ban green cards, stopped all asylum seeking at the border. They just basically put up the walls. Did South Korea do that, or are people still able to come in and out of the country? And if so, how are they doing it safely?
Well, I mean, that's one thing that I have been really pressing some of the thought leaders here in Hawaii is, you know, we are also similarly to South Korea down to single digits in terms of new cases in the last 10 days. I think there were only 14 cases in Hawaii. And I think the fear is the tourists and the people that come outside of Hawaii. And, you know, there's so many asymptomatic people. And so South Korea has actually done an amazing job. They have basically, once people land at Incheon International Airport, they're sent to kind of like a government hotel, and they're forced to quarantine there for 2 weeks. And
I understand that they're also made to take tests right as they land, and with temperature checks, and the test turnaround time is very quick.
Is very quick. I mean, 6 hours. And so, they are taking it seriously. And then again, I would say that it's, you know, the collective mindset. I mean, yes, the downside is South Korea has, I think because of their experience with SARS a few years ago, they have really instituted this like pretty intense surveillance system. And I think that's where a lot of the left is very concerned with how the South Korean government is tracking. But also at the same time, I mean, South Korea was voted one of the most democratic countries in the world, which I think is very important in a region like Asia, where there is so much militarization and rising authoritarianism. But that they have managed to do it in a really democratic way, in a way that the public feels that the government is working on their in their best interest and communicating with as much detail and with science. And so I think all of these things taken together, it is such a stark contrast to what we're seeing in this country and how the Trump administration has just totally botched any effort to contain this pandemic.
Right. I mean, there seem to be, broadly speaking, two categories that nations have fallen into. One, which is going the authoritarian route, top-down controls, China, Hungary. And then there's the sort of free-for-all disorganized mess, which is what the United States is doing. But then there is that third way that nations like South Korea are showing, that you can have democracy, transparency, science-based medicine, and actually combat the disease perhaps better than either, than even an authoritarian nation could. Because in a situation like this, you need public buy-in, right? You need people to want to wear masks, to observe social distancing. Police can't sit there and police the distance between two people, any given two people at any given time. You need public buy-in. You only get that when you have a respect for democracy.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think you said it perfectly.
So let's talk about what the other upside to what South Korea has managed can be. You wrote about North Korea and diplomacy with North Korea. And of course, a big news coming out of North Korea these days is, where is Kim Jong-un? And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that. There was rumors that he fell into a coma and hasn't revived, and then other rumors saying that he was out of the country trying to avoid catching the disease. And North Korea has claimed that they have zero cases of COVID-19.
I mean, let me just first address the issue about North Korea and COVID-19. I mean, you know, North Korea is unlikely to communicate whether they have COVID-19 or not, because if they do, then I think that they feel very subject and vulnerable to being constantly at the threat of a U.S. first strike. So, you know, I'm not saying that that's the right approach for North Korea, but I would say that's probably undergirds a lot of the reason why they try to detract from, confirming cases. As to Kim Jong-un, let's just start with, where did the source come from? It came from an anonymous source from a South Korean news site run largely by North Korean defectors called NK Daily. And then CNN basically blew it up. And it's incredible to me how just after 17 days of Kim Jong-un's absence, he has been absent for like up to 41 days. There has been mass hysteria that he's dead or this or that. Well, Moon Jong-in, who is President Moon in South Korea, senior envoy in North Korea, tried to put it to rest. He said, based on our intelligence, Kim Jong-un is alive and he is well. But that has not stopped the rumor mill, the echo chamber that just continues. I think there were 400,000 tweets that Kim Jong-un is dead. Our concern is that this just, it just falls into this collapsism framework that has, shaped and undergird U.S. policy for the last 70 years. And if anybody who has studied the North Korean system and the regime, we know that this government has made every effort to prepare for any kind of disaster, from U.S. first strike regime change to what they experienced during the famine in the 1990s. So we don't know entirely what is happening to Kim Jong-un, but I think it's safe to say that we should trust the South Korean sources when they say that he is alive and well, and that we should actually redirect the conversation to how can we actually have a diplomatic relationship so that we don't just depend on satellite images of a train in Wonsan that is, you know, where Kim Jong-un is. Wouldn't it be better to actually have a relationship? And if we are so concerned about the conditions in North Korea and the fate of the North Korean people, the best thing we can do is actually make peace. We can end the 70-year war with North Korea.
And President Trump had promised that he was making peace with North Korea, at least between the U.S. and North Korea, maybe jumping on the bandwagon after South Korean President Moon Jae-in had sort of paved the way. Nothing really seems to have come of that in the end. I mean, you and I talked many times over the course of the past several years about the progress that was being made, regardless of our opinion of Trump and Trumpism. That was a potential bright spot with the Trump administration trying to go further toward peace with North Korea than any Democratic president in recent years had certainly done, Obama. But what came of it?
Well, I think you're right. I think the right thing that Trump did was to meet with Kim Jong-un. I think the Singapore Declaration was the right approach, a commitment to transforming 70 years of war into normalized relations with North Korea. But the problem is the Trump administration's approach has been, on the one hand, Trump having this personal relationship with Kim and expecting that that's going to resolve 70 years of war. When on the other hand, the US has been waging a very brutal, draconian maximum pressure campaign, which has included intensifying sanctions against that country. It has included diplomatic isolation of that country, and has also included military exercises with South Korea. And so I think the important takeaway is that the stalled progress between the U.S. and North Korea is not just impacting the security of Americans or North Korean people, but it's also greatly delaying progress between North and South Korea. So Moon Jae-in, who has been kind of the key interlocutor between the U.S. and North Korea, but also in really, you know, extending an olive branch to North Korea. And what is hopeful to me in this moment is that Moon Jae-in has announced that they're going to take small steps. April 27th was the second year anniversary of that, you know, like world-watched Panmunjom meeting at the DMZ between Kim and Moon. And he had said at his two-year anniversary speech that they are going to proceed. They're going to take small steps. And one thing that they're going to do is to try to link the inter-Korean railroad that had been stalled. And guess who had put the kibosh on that? It was the U.S. under the guise of the U.N. command, saying that that would be a violation of sanctions. They put up all this red tape preventing the two Koreas. And in, I think it was in October of 2018, after, you know, two summits, two declarations were signed, the two Koreas began the process of demilitarizing the joint security area, demining portions of the DMZ. You know, Pompeo basically put in a call to Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa from South Korea and said, hey, 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 wait a minute, you guys are moving way too fast. And unfortunately, that followed by the collapse of talks in Hanoi, thanks to John Bolton, we have been in a serious impasse. And so the bright spot is, this is the 70th anniversary of the Korean War. I think Korean people on the peninsula and around the world feel the urgency to end this war that has had devastating consequences, not just for the North Korean people who live on a day-to-day against sanctions, such as North Korean women whose livelihoods have been destroyed by these sectoral sanctions that target so many industries in which they work, but think about the thousands, tens of thousands of Korean families and the elders who yet are, you know, waiting in line to see their loved ones in North Korea. And I think this pandemic and the swift response by South Korea and the model that it has exhibited to the world shows that right now, this is the opportunity for North and South Korea to start to collaborate and to move this peace process forward, because certainly we are not waiting on the Trump administration.
Is there an opening for coronavirus diplomacy, if you will, if North Korea is likely to be struggling with the virus? Even though it is a closed society, it's hard for travelers to come in, but it's also a society that has been decimated by decades of sanctions. It's a poor, incredibly poor society. South Korea, you mentioned, has helped to send supplies here to the United States. Is it making similar offers to North Korea? And can, you know, sanctions be eased around medical supplies?
Yeah, and I think that's the piece that I wrote with Dr. Park, is that the global context has changed dramatically with this pandemic. And one is the call for a global ceasefire put forth by Secretary General of the UN, Antonio Guterres. And, you know, the US and South Korea agreed to cancel the joint military exercises this spring. I think that President Moon can take it a step further and say, we are calling off the military exercises permanently until we resolve, while we are in this peace process. And the other thing is, I think the global call for lifting sanctions, especially those that are impeding humanitarian aid. We know Michelle Bachelet, the head of the Human Rights Commission of the UN, also issued a call, her concern. And, you know, thankfully we're seeing some movement towards that end. But, you know, I think the thing that will really help improve the situation and help North and South Korea in its peace process is the U.S. taking a stand, taking a different approach than the maximum pressure campaign. And, you know, I hope that as we move towards, you know, more debate in this country over the presidential election, that we see some shift from the Biden campaign. My concern is that we're going to return back to the Hillary Clinton style, Barack Obama, you know, strategic patience. We are holier than thou and unwilling to engage with the North Korean regime. And, you know, even the UN Special Rapporteur on North Korea Human Rights, Thomas Quintana, recently said that he urges the United States to negotiate a peace agreement with North Korea separate from a denuclearization deal, because that is the path to improving human rights in North Korea. So I think that there is a new consensus, it's a new day, and, you know, the United States, and especially the Democratic Party, must come along with this new reality.
Finally, Christine, I want to just turn back to South Korea and its approach to coronavirus. One of the things, as we mentioned, was that South Korea has provided COVID tests to the United States. So specifically, the governor of Maryland and his wife, who is of Korean origin, helped to procure 500,000 tests from South Korea, which is the kind of test I'm imagining South Korea has used very successfully to track and limit the spread of its disease. However, the state of Maryland has not been able to use those tests yet because the Federal Drug Administration, the FDA, has refused to validate them, refused to approve them as of yet. I mean, this is just kind of unbelievable because, of course, the Trump administration tends to function more on pride than on actual science.
I know. I mean, even Trump, I think, tweeted something about or said at a press conference recently that he got a call from Moon Jae-in congratulating him for his handling of COVID and the massive testing. I mean, what a joke. Mm-hmm. I'm sure President Moon is very diplomatic with President Trump and has always constantly, like, positively encouraging him on. But, you know, I think it's time for South Korea to take the lead and for us to support that government, who has managed so swiftly and effectively the coronavirus pandemic. And now it's time for us to allow South Korea to take the lead. Right. In pursuing rapprochement with North Korea.
And it would be great for the U.S. media to sort of put away their notions of American exceptionalism and point to South Korea and other nations like it. We'll be covering New Zealand on our show tomorrow to see how those nations have led the way, respected democracy, and in fact exercised great democracy while combating the virus. Christine, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to the article that you co-wrote from our website and share it with our audience.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Christine Ahn, founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. She recently wrote an article titled, South Korea is a Model for Combating COVID-19. It should now take the lead in diplomacy with North Korea. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. KBOO